You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
My name is Jessica Matthews. I'm president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and so it's my great pleasure today to welcome you to joining us in what I think will be an enlightening and, if perhaps sobering, but very important discussion of what we can hope for from Copenhagen, what we can expect from Copenhagen, and what we do next, both I think domestically and internationally, more importantly. We have three distinguished speakers to enlighten us, and it is in particular a great pleasure to welcome Margot Wallström, who is the Vice President of the European Commission with responsibility for institutional relations and communication. And before holding this job, she was served for 5 years as Europe's Environment Commissioner. Before that, in her career, she spent most of her professional life in Swedish politics and government, both as a member of parliament and in several different ministerial positions. Joining her are two old personal friends, or let's say long-standing personal friends.
One look at the gray hair.
Yeah, I think old is right? It's okay.
It was a little slip. Eileen Clausen, to my far right here, president of the Pew Center on Global Climate Change and Strategies for the Global Environment. Eileen is a former Assistant Secretary of State for Oceans, International Environment, and Science, and before that served for 3 years as the Senior Environmental Expert, Assistant to the President on the National Security Council. She also has served as Chairman of the United Nations Multilateral Montreal Protocol Fund, and also in her career as Director of Atmospheric Programs at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. So she has had a foot in basically every sector of our dealing with this issue. And next to Eileen, Mohamed El-Ashri, a former colleague of mine at the World Resources Institute, currently a senior fellow at the United Nations Foundation, chairman and CEO emeritus of the Global Environmental Facility, and a member of the board of directors of the National Council for Science and the Environment. Prior to leading GEF, Dr. El-Ashri was the chief environmental advisor to the president and director of the environmental department at the World Bank. Before that, he, as I mentioned, he served as senior vice president for the World Resources Institute, where we were colleagues, and earlier at the Tennessee Valley Authority. So like Eileen and like, in fact, all of our speakers have had experience in and out of government and in various different sectors, both of national and international management and agencies on this issue. So I think we have a terrific panel. The Copenhagen meeting has been, I think, in my long experience in international affairs, one of the most eagerly anticipated negotiations. It's been sitting out there as a goal for a great many years. And we now, with less than 2 months to go, face, I hope I'm not jumping the gun or overstating, but I think the reality that we are not coming out of Copenhagen with a ratifiable agreement, notwithstanding all the work that has gone into preparations for it. We want to explore today what we can get out of it, how Copenhagen can be used to extend forward efforts towards reaching a global agreement, and how we, and to try to identify what are the key, both the key issues and the key steps that might be taken. So without taking any more of our time, let me ask Ms. Wallström to begin. We hear from each of our speakers. I'm going to then give them a chance to mix it up because I think we have some different views in the panel, and then I will give you all a chance to mix it up, and I look forward to the discussion. So thank you. And whichever you're, I think yeah, so, but thank people you. Can see you better.
Thank you. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. One of my favorite Swedish authors, Sven Lindqvist, once wrote, "You already know enough. So do I. It is not knowledge we lack. What is missing is the courage to understand what we know and to draw conclusions." And I actually find these words appropriate when it comes to fighting climate change. Obviously, we don't know everything about the changing climate and its repercussions, but we do know that it is happening. Science is telling us that action is needed now. And if we fail to agree on a new global climate regime, we would put the whole world in a very dangerous situation. But do we have the courage to understand and to act? For me, the answer is quite simple. We cannot afford not to. And it is also very simple because I have two sons and I would like them to be able to live a good life on this planet and life on this planet as we know it. But first, I would like to say something about the economic opportunities in fighting climate change. And the famous Stern review that put a price on climate change estimates that failing to act will cost between 5 and 20% of the world's GDP every year. And the cost for the emission cuts we need to make is estimated to be only 1%. The fight against climate change gives us the opportunity to create new jobs and develop new sources of economic growth through innovation and investments in green technologies, technologies such as energy efficiency, renewable energy, and cleaner cars, which promise to transform our economies into sustainable, low-carbon economies of the future. The European Union's unilateral commitment to cut our emissions to at least 20% below 1990 levels by 2020, the adoption of a climate and energy package with binding measures, and our ongoing energy efficiency program, all these testify to our determination to make the low-carbon economy a reality. No other region of the world has both committed to such ambitious targets and put in place concrete measures to achieve them. But of course, Europe, responsible for 14% of global greenhouse gas emissions, cannot solve the climate crisis alone. What is needed then in Copenhagen? Well, what is needed is a roadmap to a low-carbon economy on a global scale. And this is what Copenhagen must provide in the shape of an ambitious and comprehensive global agreement covering the period after 2012. And in line with the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities, industrialized countries' collective emissions need to cut to 25 to 40% below 1990 levels by 2020 if global warming is to be kept to 2 degrees Celsius. But the science tells us that action by the industrialized world alone is no longer enough, and to keep temperatures below danger level, the Copenhagen Agreement also needs the developing countries, and first and foremost, the big emerging economies, of course, to control their rapid emissions growth. As our own contribution to a global and comprehensive agreement, the European Union has always made clear that we will scale up our emissions reduction target for 2020 from 20 to 30%, provided that other major players do their fair share too. In practice, this means that we are looking to other developed countries to commit to emission reductions that are comparable, though not necessarily identical to ours. Developing nations will need to make adequate contributions to the global effort, contributing and according to their responsibilities and respective capabilities. At the same time, we have to recognize that the poorest countries, those least responsible, will be also the most vulnerable and exposed to climate change. And this is a moral obligation. Copenhagen must deliver a global agreement based on social and development needs, burden sharing, and the polluter pays principle. Developing countries will also need substantial financial and technological assistance from the industrialized world. And this is necessary to help them both to limit their emissions, not least those caused by deforestation in tropical countries, and to strengthen their resilience to climate change through adaptation. And the EU is committed to contributing our fair share to this financing. Finally, with fewer than 2 months to go until the Copenhagen conference, an enormous amount of work is still ahead of us to reach an agreement that will tackle climate change both effectively and equitably. I continue to believe that we will reach our objective until you say something different here. But the ambition level and the pace of the discussions must urgently be raised. And virtually all our partners in the developed world have now put forward their emissions targets, but these fall considerably short of what is required. So far, they add up to a collective emission cut between 9 and 15% below 1990 levels by 2020. Far from holding global warming below the danger level of 2 degrees Celsius, these targets would actually allow the temperature rise to exceed 3 degrees Celsius, leading to a high risk of irreversible and possibly catastrophic changes in the global environment. Our partners in the developed world need to show leadership and come forward with revised targets, and what is on offer now cannot be their last word. Will Copenhagen be a success or not? It has to be. And I actually believe it will be because we cannot afford to fail. And this is ultimately a question of political will, and I believe that will exist. Given the scientific warnings and of the changes that we are already experiencing, and again, it's the poorest countries in the world that are first and hardest hit, it is also hard to imagine how the political will or courage could be lacking. Continuing with business as usual will lead us to unabated climate change with disastrous consequences for our economies and millions of people, and we cannot fail these people or the generations to come. I hope that the global agreement will lay the foundations for a truly sustainable development in the 21st century, and sustainable not only in environmental but also in economic and social terms. And development cannot be sustainable unless it's equitable. And that means promoting also human rights and democracy. It means ensuring peace, gender equality, and social justice. It means working for fairer world trade and remodeling our global financial system so that they serve people rather than only markets. And it's like the Chinese proverb says, one generation plants a tree, the next generation gets the shade. Thank you for listening.
Well, let me say before I start that I really am a yes, we can person. But maybe I should actually just sort of lay a bit of groundwork here. I think everyone who's been involved in this issue agrees on the goal for Copenhagen, which is a new comprehensive and binding treaty. I think we need a flexible framework which allows for different types of commitments. You know, for developed countries, I think they have to be absolute and economy-wide emissions targets. The developed countries have to put finance on the table to help the developing countries move forward into a low-carbon economy. I think for the developing countries, we can have a range of policy commitments like carbon intensity goals, efficiency standards, renewable energy targets, or programs to reduce deforestation, but they must be measurable, reportable, and verifiable so that we have something that's real. So if you sort of set that out there as a goal, I think it's worth thinking about exactly what is possible in Copenhagen. And I think that the limited progress in the last international negotiation session in Bangkok underscores the challenges we have. When that meeting started, I thought there were three big interrelated issues to be resolved. I actually now think there are four, which is going in the wrong direction. Let me just sort of quickly give you my sense of where we are in all of them. Developed country targets, financing, and developing country commitments were the three that we went in with. I think the fourth that we also come out with is what is the legal shape of the agreement, and that's actually a huge issue. And I think I also have to say that substantive negotiations on the core issues have yet to begin. I mean, we went in with a very big text. It's now a slightly smaller text. Some of the extraneous stuff is out, but everybody's wish list is still in there. So there's a huge amount of work that has to be done. Now, it's hard to do this, but I think the main reason that we are not further along on the three big issues that we started with is that the U.S. is really not able to say what it's prepared to offer in terms of a specific target. And we're not prepared because we had 8 years of sort of denying the relevance of this issue and not really moving forward. And it's really only been 9 to 10 months of a new president who is committed to doing something on this issue, but is constrained because he can't do everything by himself in our system. You actually need the Congress. And so let me just sort of give you a slight aside here. It's great that we actually got a bill through the House. I mean, it may not have everything that everybody wants, but it does set some absolute reduction targets. I think it's a decent bill. I mean, we all would like to see certain changes to it, but in general, it's a decent bill. But if you look at where the Senate is, I think before Copenhagen, you will probably have a bill that emerges from the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. But that committee is not really representative, in my opinion, of the Senate as a whole, and it's going to require a great deal of work. And if you assume that health care takes into December to get resolved, I don't see how it's possible for the Senate to actually act on this until the first quarter or the first 4 months of 2010, which I think is possible, but that is not exactly right for Copenhagen. So if the U.S. doesn't have a target to put on the table, will the developing countries be willing to put real commitments on the table? I think we've seen some encouraging signs here. I mean, China and India have both started to talk seriously about national commitments, but they haven't taken the step to say we're willing to make these internationally binding. And, of course, I think they're not willing to do that, because we don't have something on the table. So that there's a relationship there. But the third issue, which is finance, is also crucial because I don't think the developing countries will commit to anything in an international agreement unless we have a mechanism and some dollars, some amounts of money to put on the table. And if you look at where the negotiations have gone, there is no agreement on the mechanism at this point, and only the European Commission has actually put a number on the table. So we're really far away in that area. And then the fourth one, which really emerged in a big way in the Bangkok meeting, was what is the shape of this new agreement? I mean, the U.S. Has said that it wants an entirely new agreement. The EU, Japan, and Australia want a new agreement, but with Kyoto incorporated into it. The developing countries want to save Kyoto, essentially. They like the notion of binding targets for developed countries, but no real commitments for them. So how all of that gets sorted out and what the final shape of the agreement as a whole is, I think we just barely sort of touched on it. And there are five more negotiating days and then Copenhagen. And if you add that to all of these other issues, which are not resolved yet, I think it's impossible to really get to a binding international agreement. So what can you get to that will be helpful, and how do we make as much progress as possible so we can get to a binding international agreement as soon as possible? Because I think, again, we all agree that's where we need to go. Well, I think we won't get anywhere without real engagement from heads of state. And I think there are all kinds of opportunities for that. There's a U.S.-China summit. There's talk of a leaders' summit on the heels of the APEC meeting. I think we actually have to get the leaders to find some way to talk to each other about what is possible. My most optimistic view is that maybe we can have a solid framework agreement that at least lays out all the parameters with some of the details to be filled in later. But that's actually quite tricky because the ask of developing countries is agreeing, in principle at least, to a commitments-based framework without any knowledge of what the number from the U.S. would be, and we're just not on the right track to actually provide that. So what can you actually get from Copenhagen? Well, some people have said you could get a strong political statement, an agreement to get to 2 degrees, and then a date certain to conclude the negotiations. And that may be where we end up. I think it's really important to have a date certain, because otherwise you're sort of in this never-never land, and it's not clear that you ever actually get anywhere. What that date certain should be, I think, is difficult, because since we are at least part of the problem here, I think we have to look at when we actually might be able to do it and when the president can actually go and say, this is our number. And if I was in government, which happily I am not any longer, I would say I at least need to see the Senate act. I don't need to go to conference, and I don't need to actually sign something, but I actually need to have a clear idea of what the Senate target will be. I think it has to be in the first half of 2010 because it's an election year. And if you know U.S. politics, it's certainly not going to be in the second half of 2010. So, I mean, if I was picking a date, and I'm so glad I'm not, I would say maybe mid-2010, maybe June, May or June. So maybe you get as far as you can in Copenhagen and then try to finish it up in about 6 months. So my sobering story. Thank you.
Well, in between the very optimistic and the sobering views, there is another view that lies in between.
And that's what I would like to share
with you, if I can read my notes, because this is just the level in between my glasses that see far and without my glasses that see very close.
So, would you be better sitting down if you prefer?
It might be easier because there are numbers that I want to hear.
You were right. You're old friends.
And that's when you get lost between two settings. So, is this on? Yes, it is on. Okay, very good. One of the advantages, really, of being last is that the people before you have outlined, you know, what is really needed, you know, in a major comprehensive deal or agreement, and what are some of the issues that are still remaining. So I can just go ahead and, you know, get to the points that I want to make. So the question that we are starting with is, can a deal be reached at Copenhagen? And the answer is yes, but the question really should be, what kind of an agreement or what kind of a deal that ought to be reached? We all know that since Poznan, or even going into Poznan a year ago, it has become obvious that the comprehensive deal that many of us sought and had hoped to have by the time that Copenhagen comes would be upon us is not going to be possible. And I think we heard many of the reasons now why. So rather than focusing on areas of disagreements, which are still, you know, many, perhaps we can just step back and focus on where we had agreement. And where we had agreement was the Bali Action Plan, or the road map, and the four pillars: mitigation, adaptation, technology, and finance, something that we had actually proposed out of the Global Leadership for Climate Action that has 25 global leaders, including 13 former presidents and prime ministers, as well as current and past global leaders. The first two, mitigation and adaptation, basically constitute the actions that need to be made, and, of course, technology and finance are the means to facilitate these actions on the mitigation and adaptation side, as well as help with their implementation. So if we could envision a two-step approach, the first step in Copenhagen, we would agree on areas of immediate action that are core elements to any strategy for dealing with climate change. We used to call them building blocks over the last 6 months or a year, and now some people were not happy that these are just building blocks. So we said, okay, let's call them core elements, and then we can help shape them along the way. 10 days ago, the UN Foundation and the Center for American Progress released a report that identified ambitious but achievable goals in three areas for mitigation: energy efficiency, renewable energy, and forests. Then we went to McKinsey and Company and we said, if you could look at these targets and tell us how much emission reductions they would constitute by 2020. And their conclusion is that they could achieve 75% of the emissions reductions that are needed in 2020 to prevent warming beyond 2 degrees centigrade. But they also concluded that you can actually achieve that while generating a net benefit of $14 billion by 2020. Those 75%, what the target of the 20% by 2020 is equivalent to 17.4 gigatons of carbon dioxide equivalent. This strategy here would give us about 13.2 gigatons of carbon dioxide. In the case of energy efficiency, by raising annual energy efficiency gains from the current average of 1.25 to 2% by 2015, which would be equivalent to 5.4 gigatons, and a reduction of 12% of the emissions needed by 2020, we'd end up with a net benefit of $98 billion by 2020, a year by 2020. Increasing renewable energy, on the other hand, to 20% by 2020 would reduce emissions by 10% at a net cost of $34 billion, and that would be equivalent to 1.3 gigatons. Forest conservation and sustainable land use, which is the third area, by reducing deforestation by 50% by 2020, would reduce emissions by more than 50% and a net cost of 51%. So you have the benefits are largely in the energy efficiency, and they help paying for the other two, and a net still benefit of $14 billion a year. So these are actions that can be pursued by countries in their own interest. They might be ambitious, but at the same time, they are achievable, and at the same time, they have benefits to the countries themselves. And in fact, and I think Eileen mentioned that, major countries like China and India, and of course, we know the U.S. is starting now, but we're not there yet, and the EU, of course, have been there for some time now, have put or are putting in place ambitious national plans for energy efficiency, renewable energy, and forests. And we can go over some of that during the discussion in terms of the specific commitments of China, specific commitments of India, and even Brazil on the deforestation side, and the aspects of the U.S. legislation or the regulatory mechanisms that are being proposed in the U.S., and we're all familiar with the 20-20-20-by-20 of the EU. So as a first step, an agreement in Copenhagen on these immediate actions could build confidence among parties and lead to a broader deal shortly afterwards as the second step in this approach, which can answer some of the questions that Eileen mentioned here in particular, what shape of an agreement it ought to be legally and otherwise. And if I may just use the words of the Minister of India, Ramesh, who had been described as being very negative and taking negative positions. Well, 10 days ago he was in Washington and they actually put out a very good plan of what they are actually doing and concluded by saying that let's focus first on specific performance targets embedded in domestic legislation. And he started using the words outcome national mitigation outcomes instead of national mitigation actions. And I think that's encouraging, and it's a way of trying to enter into getting some sort of an agreement in Copenhagen along the lines that I was describing.
But key to it, since these are national actions, national domestic actions, and national targets that are trying to lead into a global target, then the review mechanism becomes important, and that's where you need credible but also transparent mechanism, review and monitoring to monitor progress on implementation. Finally, on adaptation and linking to finance, again, a proposal has been made for the last 6 months, first from the Global Leadership for Climate Action and then with the Swedish Commission on Climate and Development that I also had the honor of being a member of, that developed countries put on the table immediately $1 to $2 billion to help the least developed countries and the vulnerable small island developing states who are already experiencing the impacts of climate change be able to implement their own national programs of action, adaptation programs of action that have been prepared among 39 countries. The GEF, even for my time, we helped fund that, and they are sitting there waiting to be implemented. So here we can move into implementation, show goodwill, and raise the confidence of the developing countries that the developed countries are actually serious about helping with the adaptation aspect and putting some aspects of finance. Of course, the $1 to $2 billion will not be enough to get the confidence that the other speakers were talking about. So we got to talk also about another number. And that number has not really been said except by the European Commission. And as a result, it actually hinders addressing the other issues because you need the finance for the technology cooperation, for the mitigation actions, for other adaptation actions, but the other developing countries who are vulnerable. So ultimately, the last thing I want to say, so that these do not appear to be small pieces in a big ambition that we all have, is that recognizing that climate change is closely linked to development, economic development, and the need for a low-carbon economy future based on low-carbon economy, as Ms. Wallström said, is really the way to go. So if we think about these steps leading us towards that future that is based on low-carbon economy and taking immediate action so that we don't lose the momentum on what needs to be done to address the what the scientists are telling us about climate change, I think would be the way to go. And, of course, we can't forget about political will and leadership. And I would ask Europe that has carried the leadership flag over the last 8 years or so when the U.S. was silent or actually being negative and when the developing countries were watching what's happening to continue to play that leadership role. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Let me offer the panelists a chance and maybe to start, Ms. Wallström, with you as to whether this American cold water on the idea of the original goal for Copenhagen is, in your view, justified or not, or whether how you would respond to that, to what you've heard.
I think so far we have realized that it is a matter of managing expectations for Copenhagen. Maybe that is easier than managing disappointment afterwards. What you are outlining here is already a two-step approach. You are saying that we will not get there in Copenhagen, but we have already now to plan for what will come after Copenhagen. And that would be also a pedagogic challenge, I would say, to explain this to those that today have much higher expectations for a result. And I think the most important change is that we have today a general public that expects a lot, and we have lots of young people, not least, who wants us to take action. And, of course, this has built up to a situation where Copenhagen is seen also symbolically as a very, very important place and event and time for decisions. I think also we have a very different situation when it comes to the scientific evidence, and this is the change I've seen, of course, also in the U.S. over the years, that today this is established scientific knowledge, and it is not questioned as it was in those days when we first met Elaine. And that is very important, but it means also that the pressure builds on Copenhagen. And we have done that before. We've actually been in negotiations on climate change where we stopped the clock, where we said we will fail now, but we stop the clock and we meet again in another place to actually see if we can agree. And we managed to agree. But I think that the time schedule that you anticipate here would maybe not allow us to stop the clock, but in that case say that we have to have a continuation. What you said about the leaders taking responsibility is also very important, because, and that is why you need your president to go there, to Copenhagen. I think that is absolutely crucial.
You already
crucial.
Tried that once.
I know that, but I think that's a different game, and altogether a different game. Let's leave football and sports to the side. But this time he has to go, I would say, if that has not sunk down yet. It has to it has to be told again that he has to go, and of course that will in itself be such a strong signal. If the leaders go, they don't want to go there with a failure. They don't want to leave with a failure. So they have also tied themselves to the mast if they go to Copenhagen. I think they need to feel that no, they're not going down. You know, we are in the situation in the European Union where we want to do both things at the same time, and that's a difficult balancing act. We want to keep pressure up on the United States. We want to keep repeating our message. You have to do everything possible to get a deal and to have something to contribute in Copenhagen. At the same time, we understand the practical problems here and the political problems of getting to a deal and getting full all the decisions necessary through the Senate. We understand that this will be very difficult. We are still in that balancing act, and we want to continue to say we want all the others on board as well. And we will not get them there unless there is something promising in the commitments and in the discussions leading up to Copenhagen. So we will continue to sort of keep pressure up, and at the same time we cherish the political signals coming from the United States. So if there is a way of ensuring that if we don't reach the whole way and to the ultimate target that we have, that we have to ensure that there is a continued process. And exactly how to design that, I have no idea. We take one step at a time, but I think there were interesting ideas. And maybe to be, as you said, be concrete enough in a first step would actually then hold this whole procedure together. And I hope that we have insisted on bringing the two tracks, the one on the convention and the one on the protocol, together, and we think that that is reasonable. But I hope that this does not take over, because we will probably love these things to negotiate on the procedures as such. But if that means that we lose sight of what we are there to do, to deliver results and real emission reductions, then I think it's bad. And I hope that we will find a reasonable framework within which we can work. And to us also, the protocol with a number of provisions has been helpful. The emissions trade, the flexible mechanisms, the emissions trading, the whole concept of common but differentiated responsibilities. It has been a good tool in many ways.
Eileen or Mohammed?
I just want to raise two issues, one based on what you just said and one based on what you said. I agree it's a difficult balance between keeping the pressure up and not blaming the U.S. for everything, or however you want to sort of coat that. But part of the problem with keeping the pressure up is that it keeps the expectations up. And I think you started by saying part of this is a question of expectations, and I think we have to be really careful how we sort of glide into something real but possible in Copenhagen. And too much keeping the pressure up just makes me very nervous that then it's sort of you might fall off a cliff. And I think that would be terrible for all of us who care about this issue. So just a point.
And before you go on, can I just ask, doesn't keeping the pressure up also keep you from working on fallbacks?
Well, it does. It does. We've been saying this for quite some time and got enormous pushback for probably saying it too early, that maybe you can't get there. And now I think, at least in the, privately, everybody agrees you can't get there. But publicly, they're still keeping the pressure up. And in fact, we're not actually working on what a possible deal is. With respect to your core elements, I think this is an interesting idea. But if you've got this train going down this track toward an agreement with a midterm target and an end sort of target in 2050, I don't see how, with 5 negotiating days before Copenhagen, you turn the ship around and all of a sudden get everyone to agree on targets for energy efficiency or targets for renewables. It's not that it's a bad idea. I don't see how that can. It takes more work than the kind of thing that I was thinking about. I don't see how you get there.
Tell us how you get there.
but just really to show the agreement here is that all or nothing is a bad strategy, and we should not really look at Copenhagen as the end of the line, but as an important milestone towards achieving the kind of an agreement, comprehensive agreement, that is needed to address climate change at the scale that the science is telling us. Are we too late? I don't think so. Not just being the optimist, but also based on the history that's out there. Of course, if we continue with the notion of 5 days of negotiations and then we go to Copenhagen, it's not going to work. But if there is a will, there is a way. And the way I would propose it is that, as happened even in the original negotiations on the Climate Change Convention, is that you would have working groups, made of countries, big and small, so that no one sees themselves isolated. Because at some point in time, someone suggested that maybe the G20 can do that. Maybe the MEF can do that. But you can't really work it out among 20 countries and then take it in Copenhagen for the 180-some countries and say, now, endorse that. So if someone got to take the leadership role among the parties and try to get an agreement on establishing working groups to start looking at that first major step that would make Copenhagen a success, keeping in mind that there is the longer vision of the bigger agreement and the shape of the agreement, because, as you said, we love processes, and we can sit and discuss, words and commas and punctuations, as long as we want, and we'll never get to anything. So having some substance, at the table and say, okay, what does it look like, taking this into action, moving forward for the second step, but these are things that we can do now. And the one thing I did not really mention earlier is that even if you reach an agreement in Copenhagen, the big agreement, it will not be implemented till 2013, right? So that's another 4 years from now, whereby here you're talking about actions that can be really taken now without having to wait for the ratification, because it is not the legal agreement yet, but it's a major part of that final agreement or comprehensive agreement.
Just to clarify for me, in the case of the U.S., what you're suggesting is the president would go in and say, our national target is going to be X. And then what? He then goes to the Hill and says, whatever bill that comes out of your deliberations has to at least meet this target? Is that?
Well,
am I just trying to understand?
Yeah. No, I'm not an expert on how, the U.S. system would work.
I think not that way.
You have about a month and a half before Copenhagen. So before the president goes to Copenhagen or the vice president or whoever, there is a period of time here, if there is a process that's agreed to, and we start talking about certain global targets and how they can be met with national, you know, targets and national commitments, then there is enough time for the administration working with Congress and the Hill to try to get at least the broad features of what these national commitments can be. But they are national commitments and not global commitments. They are national commitments towards meeting a global target. So the criticism that is being held that how can the administration actually agree to a global target when it has, I mean, to its contribution to a global target before a legislation could be moderated quite a bit.
Say something, Eileen, out loud?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think you could look at authorities that the administration has to use. You could take a look at the proposed rule for autos, which has come out of EPA. You could take a look at other possible EPA actions under the Clean Air Act. You could take a look at the appliance efficiency standards and things like that at DOE that you could ratchet up. And you could add it all up and see where you are. And, in fact, I mean, I've asked whether they're doing that because I actually think it's really important that they do that, and apparently they are doing it, but I don't know exactly what the answers are. I think it's a beginning, but it is nowhere near what you need to get to a reasonable 2020 target that at least comes close to what the science is telling you. I'm not even saying gets there, but even comes close. So what does that do? I'm just trying to think about all the ways that Copenhagen doesn't end up in the blame the U.S., and I'm afraid that if that's the thing, that could just precipitate it if you're not talking about sort of anything that's even reasonably ambitious.
But at the same time, can't really accept the fact that it has to be completely a watered-down agreement so that the U.S. does not get embarrassed.
No, but I think a bad agreement is worse than putting it than sort of creating an abyss or a second where you can actually get a real one. I mean, a weak or bad agreement, I think, is a problem.
I'm afraid I will not be able to promise that we won't blame the U.S. Want me to promise that? No, but I think you have to understand also what the sort of the core dynamics of this negotiation. And this is where you have to find and where you have to look at the things to promise or the things to commit to in Copenhagen. And the core political debate is the one about, you can call it climate justice if you like, but the fact that the developing world will want to see action from the rich countries and they will want to see some money on the table because they will be first hit and they will want to see that there is some financing. So you have to address that. And maybe the other thing would be to say, we accept science today. We accept the scientific advice. And this is why we would follow with an overall sort of global target. And at least sort of agree on that, and then we can start to count backwards. If we don't reach all the way in Copenhagen, but we will continue, but that sets the frame. That sets the targets that we can all agree on a global scale. And I think then you have at least identified the most important dynamics, because otherwise you will have the whole G77, all the developing countries against. And they will be outraged that nothing can be achieved.
Can I just make one other point here? I mean, you were talking about the adaptation funding, and that's one thing, but I think you were talking and I was talking about funding to help them mitigate, to reduce emissions, which is a different story. And that, I agree, maybe that could be part of what emerges from Copenhagen.
I think we have a framework to take this discussion further, and then, before I open to the general questions, I want to just focus for a minute on China, on the number one emitter, and try to clarify for all of us how far China's recent statements take us, both positively and negatively, in the direction of a viable global agreement, and. Carnegie has been working hard on in China and on this issue for the last 2 years. And I wonder if I could ask Taya Smith, whom I can't even see. Where are you? There. Who's now leading the project, to say, Taya, just to, I mean, in the context of what you've just heard, to clarify how far President Hu's statement in the UN went and Dr. Xu's statements in Washington last week about a 40% renewables target, et cetera. What's the mix of good news and bad news, and how far do you see China, how close do you see being able to play a constructive role on this?
Sure. Well, President Hu's big announcement was that China has decided to take climate change seriously. It has made the decisions within its own internal structure to include climate change in its economic and social planning process. So for all of us, that means great things. It means that China is now fully embracing climate change, overcoming any opposition to dealing with it, and is putting in place a domestic program which will allow it to begin to deal with it. So Dr. Xu was here just last week and was spelling out some of the very specifics of what they're doing. The most notable figure has been the one that you're citing about 40% of renewables and nuclear, sort of non-fossil fuels, to be part of its energy mix. And that is part of the overall plan that China's been laying out. They are working very hard in wind and solar. They're working to construct nuclear plants and moving to a very different, as they call it, model of economic growth that is not as energy consumptive. What President Hu said in September is that China is looking to decrease its energy intensity. So for every dollar of GDP, they are going to be reducing the amount of energy that it takes to create that dollar worth of GDP. And that does not give us a cap, so it means that China's negotiating in Copenhagen with a different set of figures than other countries are looking at. And it says that they're going in the right direction, but we don't know how. His term was by a significant amount. Some will wonder what's significant. And again, it leaves us a little bit lost in terms of knowing what China's overall goal is going to be in the negotiations. So in summary, they're going in the right direction. They've made it clear they're going in the right direction. Those who watch China know that when China decides to do something, it does it faster than any other country in the world. But exactly how far they're planning to go, we're still unsure.
Thank you. Let's open the discussion now to everyone. And we'll please introduce yourself. Please wait for the microphone. We'll start right here. And then we'll I think because there's so many, I think I'm going to take three questions, comments at a time, and then turn to the panel, if that's okay with everybody.
Thanks. Alden Meyer, Union of Concerned Scientists. Question for Eileen. I think the president can go to Copenhagen with some level of certainty about the target issue, even if legislation hasn't passed. You've got the House target. Our emissions are now down 8.5% projected from 2020 without additional action. We're halfway to the Waxman-Markey bill without doing anything because of the various factors. And the executive authority that the president has that you mentioned, I think, could have a pretty credible story to tell there. But I think it's a different case on finance. I think on finance, under our Constitution, the president can't spend money without Congress. You might have an annual appropriations bill done by then, maybe not. You certainly aren't going to have the big kind of money that's in the Waxman-Markey bill, particularly for forests, anywhere near certain if the Senate hasn't acted. What credibility would the president have, particularly with the developing countries, in the absence of Senate action, that if we suspend the negotiations and come back in 6 months, he can pretty much guarantee that there'll be a serious finance issue on the table, finance offer on the table? And then for Vice President Wallstrom, on the European strategy, I think what I saw in Bangkok last week is the danger of the Europeans setting themselves up to take the blame rather than the U.S. because of the notion of shifting out of Kyoto into a single instrument without there really being a credible strategy to get that single instrument, because the U.S. is saying very clearly it does not want the things that we basically invented in Kyoto, emissions trading and the accounting system and assigned amount units and all that, transferred into the new single instrument. And, of course, the major developing countries don't want that because they see the writing on the wall that they would then have to eventually take on some targets within that new regime. So you're basically by yourself saying, let's save Kyoto by transferring it. And the developing countries are charging you with wanting to kill Kyoto by transferring it, knowing that it's not going to be transferable. So I guess the question is, what's your strategy to avoid the EU taking the blame in Copenhagen and getting President Obama off the hook?
Yes.
Thanks, Lisa Friedman with Climate Wire, and thanks for doing this. It's very useful. I also have a blame game question. I mean, watching the Bangkok talks from this side of the world last week, there seems so much anger against the United States, and I believe posturing as countries were preparing to blame the United States if Copenhagen falls apart. And so what I'm interested in getting is an assessment from any or all of you about, will it be the United States' fault if Copenhagen falls apart, or if we don't get as far as some of you are hoping we'll get? And what will, you know, to what extent will it be the United States' fault, and what will the fallout be for the administration? Thanks.
Okay. I will take one more up front, just if you can go. Thank you.
Dana Marshall with Dewey and LaBeouf, and Eileen, it's very nice to see you again after a long time. I have a sort of a question and a comment. Clearly, although the 800-pound gorilla in this whole discussion is the economy, and in a world with 10% U.S. unemployment, 20% unemployment in Spain, obviously that's a tremendous driver, perhaps the most important issue. Certainly in the United States, I think arguably it is. I may be missing something, but I have not seen in the flurry of advertisements that we see regarding trying to connect what we're trying to do here with job creation, which is the best way to pull this thing through. I've not seen any really good analysis or projection that at least I'm confident in that we're going to see a real jobs response. And let's speak just for the United States right now. In this country, if we do what people want to do, we have a situation in this country where we have trade deficits in green technology. In other words, we're importing more wind and solar equipment under OECD lists of harmonized tariff codes than we are exporting. Clearly, the discussion we just had regarding China, their role in all of this would be very important. The G20's commitment to rebalance economic flows are very important. What I'm simply saying is we need to smash through a couple of silos here, it seems to me, and try to make the jobs case more convincingly, bringing in trade, currency, labor standards, wage rates, all of those kinds of things, I think much better, or we will be in our own sandbox on this, talking about this and being able to put the commas in the right place, and we will have no answer, unless, in my view, at least it's connected to the larger issue.
Okay, let me let the panel at those three.
Well, I hope we are not putting ourselves in the firing line and taking the blame for the new procedure. I would also admit that I am not sort of in the middle of these negotiations, so I'm not sure about exactly how they are, what shape they are taking at the moment. But I just see the risk clearly that we will be so engaged in this whole negotiation on procedures that risks taking over a number of other things. And I guess the best way forward would be a very pragmatic one, to say what is it that has worked. The elements that we've been able to extract and use to the full, and that we think have been effective, and that can allow us also, for example, to use the market forces at the service of fighting climate change, and emissions trading being the best example of that. And what are the things that do not work? But of course, we will also lose a lot of energy if we keep on two tracks. And to bring everybody around the same table, of course, to merge these two tracks into one would probably be reasonable. But I would have to ask the ones who are in the proper sort of negotiations to see exactly if this is a risk that they see. I hope not. I hope we can be constructive. I think you made a very important point, and that is to make the jobs case more convincingly, as you said. And we have tried to calculate also the number of jobs that could be created, not least in renewable energy, and they are impressive figures. And already, this is happening already. We see an enormous growth, especially in the wind energy sector. thousands and thousands of new jobs being created. And this is how you have to underline sort of the business opportunities in fighting climate change. And we need also businesses on board to make that case. So I just agree. I think you're absolutely right. And I think we could maybe develop and describe and make an inventory of more of these examples, as well as give letting some of these climate witnesses have a voice. Because I think there are so many people who think that this is only something theoretical for in the future, but this is already happening. This is already affecting our world and especially the poorest people. And I think they also have to be given a voice. I think the most impressive in all the negotiations that I myself was part of, I think it was the small island states that really made a difference. They were always the ones with the sort of the strongest, made the strongest impact on all of us, because they know it sort of on their skin. And their lives have already changed. And I think more of that is maybe necessary so that it doesn't turn out as just a theoretical exercise.
Right. Okay. Two of you then. Go ahead.
I skipped the issue about will it be the U.S. fault, as you have
mentioned. I'm happy to deal with that one.
Well, just to the U.S. fault, let me just say that China used to be described as the bad actor. And so they came around very quickly and they said, you know, we are doing actually many good things. Why don't we just tell the world what we are doing? And so the focus shifted to India. And the Indians realized that, you know, they also have started really to move aggressively on that front. Of course, it is as a development strategy, but it can count also for climate, and came out with it. And now the focus is completely on the U.S. So the U.S., I think, needs to also step back and say, what is it that we can present now to show that we are actually an important player? And I think there is really many things that are happening in the U.S., but they have not been really collated together with the administration coming out, putting its weight behind it to show the world that the U.S. is not the bad guy. And when it comes to whether it's Kyoto or whether it's a different agreement, that's another story. You know, if we go with a two-step approach, then we're not really trying to figure out the legal shape of the agreement in Copenhagen. On the jobs, very important, of course, the issue. Some numbers came out of, you know, with the stimulus. You know, talking about, you know, a good part of the stimulus will go into green energy and the number of jobs it would create. But I think a good measure of it is the level of private investment in renewable energy. In 2008, despite of the recession, it was $155 billion increase, with an increase over 2007, rather than what happened with the fossil fuel industry or the nuclear industry, where it actually shrank the investment there. And I think that shows
a global figure? Global figure.
That's global, yes. But the major aspect of it, 75% of it, was in the U.S. and Europe. Developing countries were 25%. Most of them were China and India, but the major part was U.S. and Europe. And I think this is a good, you know, parameter to measure the interest in green energy is with the amount of private money that goes in, because that's ultimately what's going to drive that agenda forward. Talking about trillions of dollars that will be needed, it cannot be covered by public funds. It will have to be private investment, and the public investment can only help incentivize that.
Just some quick things. Alden, you're absolutely right about the inability to actually put a number on the table in December, given that the president doesn't have the ability to do that. Can he do it, and say, in 6 months? I mean, I hope so, but it's very difficult given our system. On your sort of how you would count up the reductions, it's true that we are way down because of the recession, but quite honestly, if things pick up, which everyone hopes they do, I'm not sure you can count on all of that. I mean, maybe some of it, but maybe not all of it. So it's not as easy a picture for him to come through with a really credible number without sort of presupposing some action by the Senate, which I think would be a real problem, because everybody has their own prerogatives, and the Senate likes to do what the Senate likes to do. And so I think you have to be careful. On how much of the blame is the U.S., I mean, I think because we don't have a target, we don't have the developing countries saying they'll make binding commitments, and I think that's dependent upon it. On the finance issue, I think it's everybody's fault because people haven't come to any agreement on the mechanism, and while we don't have a number on the table, only the Commission does, so that's everybody's fault. So, I mean, maybe we get a little more blame than most, but I actually think it's a collective failure. I mean, it's not just us, although we are certainly a part of it, and maybe the biggest part, but not entirely. On the jobs issue, you know, there are not really good data on the jobs that will be created. I mean, there have been some analyses that have been done. We've looked at all of them. We don't think any of them are really credible. So quite honestly, I don't think the jobs lost side of the equation, because there are lots of people who have very specific numbers of jobs that will be lost in a particular county in Ohio or something. Those numbers are no good either. So you've got a lot of numbers swirling around here, and you don't have a really good case. I mean, I think you have a general case that there will be jobs created, but you don't have any specifics to put on the table. You made the point about importing wind and solar from other places. That's because we don't have in place a national requirement for renewables. If we did, we actually would start manufacturing more of it, in my opinion, here, and that would help with the jobs. But we don't have a policy yet, and unfortunately, a lot of this depends on us having the right kind of policy to actually create the jobs and get things moving.
Okay, let me go to the back. Yes. There you go. It's right there.
Brian Beery from Europolitics. I have a question on, a little bit technical perhaps, on international offsets and whether they should be used or not. I was in the Senate this morning when they were discussing the money and how much cap and trade is going to cost. And one of the experts was saying from the budget office that if you use international offsets, that will reduce, that if you don't use it, it will increase the cost of reducing emissions by 90%. So it'll be way more expensive if you don't. But then the Washington senator, I think Maria Cantwell, pointed out if you do use international offsets, it will cost $1.4 trillion, and that's $1.4 trillion that of wealth and jobs that you're exporting to another country. So I'm just wondering, you know, in the more philosophical...
All of that is true.
On the philosophical point, what's the advisability of international offsets?
I mean, it's all true. I mean, all the analyses that have been done suggest that the single biggest thing that keeps the cost down are offsets. And there are domestic offsets, but there are more international offsets. And it is true that will keep the cost down. It is also true that means that there's a big flow of money out of the country. So, yes.
Okay. right in front of you. Yeah.
Hi, Sarah Ladislaw from CSIS. Thanks very much. This has been a great discussion. I agree completely with Eileen that, you know, the trade-off of keeping the pressure up is that you're running out of time to manage expectations. So I kind of think we're going to be managing disappointment instead. It's kind of close. So given that, so say, for example, we do have another round of negotiations that lasts, you know, 6 months, a year. The real political will be to sustain policies that were put in place as aspirations and gestures for a 2010 negotiation. What happens? Like, everyone talks about the consequences of failure in terms of the atmospheric consequences or the natural, you know, consequences in the natural environment. What happens to those policies, especially in Europe? You know, will you be able to sustain those policies going forward if there isn't global agreement to have similar policies in other places? Will places like China and India sustain those kind of things? How do you keep the momentum up absent sort of that global framework?
Okay, well, let's take one more before we turn back to the panel. Yes.
Hi, my name's Anthony Bowe with the Washington Times opinion editorial desk. Citing a BBC article updated yesterday and released a few days ago by Paul Hudson, it's reported that since 1998, global temperatures have not seen an increase. Professor Mojib Latif was cited in this article saying he's also a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He also said that we may be entering a period of cooling that may last for 10 to 20 years. Now, if the Earth is in a cooling right now, at least for the time being, why should the public believe that global warming is a man-made phenomenon right now and a substantial issue in today's world going into this Copenhagen summit?
Let's deal with that one quickly. Who wants to deal with it?
Well, I mean, there has always been and there will always be one or two scientists that are suspicious of the numbers that they have and questioning the numbers that they have. So what I really go with is what is the biggest majority of scientists really think as a result of reviewing the past and continuing to look ahead to the future. And that's the IPCC. And beyond their 2007, there has been lots of research articles and publications, the fact that climate change is actually proceeding at a much faster rate than they even have thought, because they stopped at the data of 2005. And when you look at 2006, 2007, and 2008, with the melting of the ice at both poles of the Earth, it's happening at a much larger rate, and with its sea level rise as well. So that's what I go with, is what is the biggest majority of the scientists think, rather than the one or two scientists here and there. And eventually their work will be reviewed by the IPCC for the next report, and then we can see then what's happening.
And deal with the 1998.
I'm not sure I can that, but I just think it's really important to understand the difference between the weather and the climate, which is a long-term trend. And I think there is no issue on the long-term trend that we're seeing here. Even if you have a little cooling, it'll be followed by more warming if we look at any of the trends going back historically.
But I think also to underline that this is a unique exercise that the United Nations brought together. I think they are more than 2,000 of the world's leading experts on climate change. And you will always find individuals who will question that, and we have a famous one in Copenhagen as well, but he's a statistician. So, okay, he maybe is an expert in his field, but we have brought together in a quite unique experiment the world's leading experts. They've done four consecutive reports where they also say these are things that we do not know fully, or that where we do not know everything, and where research has to continue. But on these things, we have solid knowledge. We think we have enough to actually also give advice for action from the politicians. I would like to see the same kind of initiative on other very important environmental and other issues, like chemicals, for example. That would be fantastic, to be able to bring together the real scientific evidence in a panel of the same character as the IPCC. So I think you can continue to sort of question it, but it's the best scientific advice we can get. And there is no doubt about that. I've often told the story that I was in Russia once, and there was this radio program, and people were asked to call in, and this woman called me, and they were asking about everything from transport and environment policy, and this woman called in and said, I'm calling from Novosibirsk. Last winter we had minus 41 degrees. Why on earth can you not let us have 1 or 2 degrees warmer? What's wrong with that? I mean, we would really need it, and this is exactly why you need to sort of be able to separate the weather and the climate change issues.
Let's turn back to the other two issues that were raised.
The very important one, will we be able to keep policies up in the EU? Yes, because they make sense. They make economic sense, they make social sense, they make environmental sense. And I think it will also keep us in a competitive advantage compared with other member states. So even if we would question climate change, what's wrong in investing in renewable energy, making us less dependent on Russia and other countries? What's wrong making sure that we are much more energy efficient? It will save us money. What's wrong investing in things that will help us to actually have a better quality of life? And it will create new jobs as well in these sectors. So I think that we will. I think that this is an awareness. We have reached a level of awareness where, and business sense as well, economic sense as well, that will allow us to continue our policies. I am not so afraid of losing momentum. But at the same time, this is a truly global problem. It requires a global solution and cooperation. And we have to be cost efficient. And that is why we also have to start in those countries where it would really make a quick and effective difference if we would act together. And we need to help those that are most exposed to the effects of climate change.
Okay, next round. Yes, way in the back.
I'm Dani Galperin from the Carnegie Endowment. Yesterday I saw an article in the New York Times about Saudi Arabia asking for compensation for oil-producing countries if the oil-consuming countries reduce their oil consumption. And I was wondering, is this a proposition that is being taken seriously? And if so, what proposals are on the table, or what's the amount that we're talking about? Thank you.
Okay. Who else would like? Yes. And we'll come back.
Hello, I'm Leon Weintraub, former member of the Foreign Service, now University of Wisconsin Semester in Washington program. I saw Eileen Clausen shake her head when someone mentioned, does President Obama go and give a target and say the same? I'd like to build on that and say, considering what we saw the response in the Senate to Kyoto, what do you think are the lessons we've learned about a better way to bring this process around? We all seem to be saying in one way or another, it's the Senate. What lessons have we learned that we can do it differently and do it better this time?
Great question. And Mac, and then I want to add something to that, but go ahead.
Thank you, Jessica. Mac Dessler, Maryland School of Public Policy. Some of my colleagues who are expert in this area at University of Maryland, including Steve Fetter, who's now working in the White House, have concluded that it's most unlikely we can, in the medium term, do much about climate change unless we have a major acceleration of nuclear production. And that seems to me raises two obvious questions. One is, it seems to me politically, it kind of strikes at the heart of the pro-climate change coalition, because a lot of the same people who have been very pro-action in environmental issues have been anti-nuclear, skeptical about nuclear. The second, of course, is the international proliferation question and the need for addressing this. This is a little bit obviously not something that comes up in Copenhagen per se, but it seems to me in the medium or long term it becomes critical to both the substantive and political prospects for action.
I would, if I may, just make a comment, and because these last two comments, as I was listening to the three of you, I've been doing a lot of work recently on the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty and on preparations for the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference, which is next spring in April and May. And I just came from a two-day board meeting of the Nuclear Threat Initiative, an international board is discussing those two treaties plus the START follow-on treaty. And it is eerie to sit here and listen to this discussion and recognize that the U.S. internationally is in almost exactly the same position on nuclear issues. The Senate, here we are, 10 years after the Senate rejected the comprehensive test ban the first time, a U.S. initiative, a country that has tested more than 1,000 times, a country that's observed a voluntary moratorium for 17 years, a country that has broken by tenfold the computer power goal that was set in 1999, to allow us to assure reliability of nuclear weapons without testing. All of those things, and the feeling is that it may not be possible to even take that treaty up for discussion in the Senate till 2011, when the goal had been to get it done before the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference, which is where we will be blamed for, with some strong degree of legitimacy, for 10 lost years and a crumbling regime. The distance between where 67 votes are in the Senate on this issue or on nuclear issues and where the reality is on the planet is just enormous. And you have to ask why. You know, you really have to, I think, at some point step back and say, what is it about our system that we can have the upper house be so utterly divorced from real threats, you know, and from real facts, and so unable to act on energy. It's been a 35-year journey. So I just mention it because I think there is almost an exact parallel to both to domestically and internationally of where we stand on these two issues. And so the question of what we've learned, not much. I mean, what do we know? We know it's hard to get 67 votes in the Senate for a vote on is today Tuesday, Wednesday, whatever it is. But on these serious issues where the case is overwhelming, we are really hobbled. Anyway, forgive my just these two questions really brought home what I'd already been thinking. So let me turn it on all these questions back to you.
I can try to do very quickly on all of them. On the Saudi Arabia compensation issue, I mean, this came up in Kyoto, too. No, we shouldn't take it seriously. On what we've learned from the Kyoto experience, I think I wouldn't say we've learned nothing, but close. I mean, one of the things that the system we followed there was the same one that we used essentially like on the Montreal Protocol, where you negotiate an international treaty and then you bring it back. And you hope to get implementing legislation and the ratified treaty. And I think there are lots of other things that sort of swirl around here, but it clearly didn't work. The Senate was generally opposed. The Byrd-Hagel resolution had gone through. We went ahead and negotiated Kyoto anyway, and then for a variety of reasons, the president's impeachment, the vice president running for president, we didn't do much to try to change anybody's opinion, but the fact is we hadn't done really good groundwork before then. I think the lesson that this administration has taken from that is that you've got to get the Senate, the Congress, to act first before you go and negotiate. And I think given our broken system and the way that it is, that is probably right. You talked about 67 votes in the Senate for a treaty. I mean, just to get something passed, you need 60. And that's a real challenge, even when you've got 50 Democrats, because the fact is, on the energy and climate issue, you're not going to get all 50. So it has to be bipartisan. When I do the counting, I think you have about 40 Democrats. You can probably pick up, of the remaining ones, you can probably pick up a couple. You're going to need a group of Republicans, and it's really hard in this system to actually get something to be bipartisan. I mean, the Kerry Graham editorial and op-ed in the New York Times on Sunday was terrific, because now I can count 3¾ Republicans who might vote for something. But I actually think we need more than that. It's really tough. On the nuclear issue, I don't see either substantively or politically how you can get to where we need to get without nuclear. I mean, it's now 20% of our electricity mix. I actually think we need probably more than that. And as a political matter, to get any of those iffy Democrats or any of the Republicans, you're going to have something that has a real push for nuclear. Yes, it does challenge the coalition of people who are favorable on this, but I think it's interesting that Greenpeace has actually been relatively quiet on this, as have others, and I think it's almost pragmatic, even in the more radical elements of the environmental community. If you really want to get this done, you're just going to have to hold your nose and take along some things that you're not wild about.
Okay, just very quickly, on Saudi Arabia, they, of course, take it very seriously, but I don't think really the rest of the world does. But just as Eileen said about Kyoto, in fact, there is a provision in Kyoto. One of the three funds, which is called the Climate Change Fund, is intended and pushed under compromise that to address the unintended consequences, economic consequences.
Right.
And that was to give in a little bit to Saudi Arabia, but I don't really think anyone takes it very seriously. And when you look at some of the other OPEC countries, particularly in the Gulf, they are following the example of the Shells of the world and BPs and Chevrons, and they're actually investing in renewable energy. And as a result, they are hosting, they're going to be hosting now the Secretariat of IRENA, the International Renewable Energy Agency, which is the newest agency related to energy. On nuclear, for the last few years since the debate on, or the tone of the debate has risen on climate change, the industry has been talking about renaissance, and that renaissance has not been reached. And it's very simple, because the industry does not want to recognize the risks that are associated with their industry. Despite the subsidies, despite everything else, it is not really growing. I personally think it's going to remain about the same percentage, particularly in this country, because I don't believe that there is a community in the United States that would accept a new nuclear power plant in its midst, but you can get decommission and rebuild the new plants where the old plants used to be, because the people have lived with them for these years. But I think overall it's going to be a very small rate of growth and not the renaissance that the industry is looking at for a variety of reasons. Proliferation, of course, is one of them. So.
I just wanted to mention one project that we're working on, which is trying to we have convened a group of all the nuclear reactor vendors in the world to try to negotiate a voluntary code of conduct that would enable you to have a nuclear renaissance safely. That is, they all recognize that they are vulnerable to the worst player. You know, one sale to a country that can't manage and where the material is stolen or there's a serious accident, and they're all at risk. On the other hand, there are fierce competitive pressures. So this project is moving forward. It's extremely dicey because some are companies and some are governments, and because it's hard to do anyway, and because the particular countries and governments are not the world's easiest to corral. But it's moved forward, and our hope is by next spring. I probably shouldn't have even said that, because it will probably mess it up. But we've had several negotiating rounds, and so far it's been quite encouraging. And I think it's efforts like that that may make it possible. I'm sorry.
May I just add another argument, because I don't think that in the medium term that this is a very effective solution, because even in our countries in Europe, where we have very high safety standards and a lot of control, the few projects and investments that have been decided on and the new nuclear plants that will be started have been delayed, has become much more costly than planned, et cetera, et cetera. So, and of course, to the poorest countries in the world, this is not the solution, and definitely not in the medium term. So it takes a very long time to project and plan nuclear these days. It's very, very expensive, and with all the problems still of managing the waste. But in the European Union, this is left to member states to decide the mix of energy sources. A lot of them use it already, but we have not seen a huge surge in wanting to invest in new nuclear. But it's in the debate constantly, of course. And just one sentence about compensation to all producing countries. They are still capable of causing a lot of distortion in the negotiations. That's the problem. They take it very seriously, and they distort the negotiations and the discussions a lot with proposals like this.
Well, on that happy thought, I hope I hope everybody would join me in thanking this terrific panel for a wonderful discussion.